Yeah, well, I don't know whether he was there or whether he disappeared.
I think he was already gone when they went.
I think he disappeared somewhere in there.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, and it may have been, if you think, it may be because he was out of the country. You know, he got a traveling fellowship. Yeah. He spent about a year.
Yeah.
You know, during the war, he was traveling a lot. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I never talked to him about it, but I know that the fact was that McGill fell out fairly early.
Yeah.
And Odom said at one point, when they were putting all this together, he said, where are all of those splendid liberal journalists who were supporting us mm-hmm. in the beginning, who all seemed to have disappeared?
Yeah.
Why he did it, I don't know.
Jonathan Daniels never had much to do with SRC.
No, Jonathan was, again, one of these weird kind of people. Jonathan was mainly a literary man.
Yeah.
And I liked John, and he was, you know, all of his instincts were good. But he didn't work hard. He was a rich man's son, and he drank a lot of whiskey, and he had the newspaper. And he was under the shadow of old Josephus.
Yeah.
He was such a long shadow. And he wrote the book, The Southern that Discovers the South, and Jonathan was always, sometime belatedly, he'd come out on the right side on these issues.
Yeah.
But he was no crusader. I mean, that,
and Carter didn't have anything to do with SRC either during that
so.
Formative time.
Well, I don't know where Hodding was. Hodding was out of Hammond, and he was a small, very small-time operator.
He was in Greenville, I guess, by then.
Greenville, then he was in the Army.
Yeah, but I'm thinking about from 45 to 50. I don't find McGill or Carter or you or Jonathan Daniels really engaged there.
Well, I said, you know, what we were trying to do was tell them it's coming.
Yeah.
And I said, you can, I said in Charlotte, I said later in Little Rock, that you could support anything that support the name of justice. It didn't involve race mixing.
Mm-hmm.
You could get away with.
Yeah.
You couldn't get support, but you wouldn't get drummed
out.
Yeah,
you wouldn't get shot.
If you went over that line, then you were going to have it. Now, that was the Brown decision blew that out of the water. From that on, it was on the table.
Yeah.
You couldn't avoid it anymore once they got to the school thing.
Yeah.
So that was really the situation. I think there was nobody in politics or in public life, minister or whatever, was preaching for desegregation until the Brown decision.
Well,
as a matter of there were a few radicals, but they had no audience. I mean,
that's what
Southern Conference for Human Welfare.
Yeah, it took them till 48.
I know that, and then they weren't talking to anybody except each other.
Nobody was listening. Right. Lillian Smith didn't have any.
No, Lillian Smith was out there beating abreast with a few blacks, and I wrote about her too. I had a great sympathy for her.
Yeah.
See, she had the artist approach. That's a very emotional, very deep-seated feeling, right and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had the same general conclusion, but my problem was how the hell do you hold the community together so you can begin to deal with the problem?
So really, when you come down to it, it's pretty hard to imagine, even in retrospect, this South coming voluntarily to social reform without the pressure of the federal courts and the black uprising.
Never would have done it without those two things. Took both of them. First of all, it took the federal decision, the Brown decision, to liberate the black movement. When people don't understand about it, I've been saying over and over again, you could take the streets in Montgomery only after Brown.
Yeah.
Before that, goddamn state troopers and police.
No
black man in his right mind would have tried to do a bus boycott until after that. And what that did, it committed the federal government, which didn't want to be there, on the side of the blacks for the first time. And that meant that all the power in the South, political, law enforcement, was in the white hands, was for the first time had a countervailing force.
Yeah.
And the whole Martin Luther King's whole movement was to pressure the Kennedys in Washington to come in.
Sure.
I mean, that's what it was all about.
Yeah.
And without them, there was certainly no indigenous support in the South. I wouldn't, I would say, weaseling even after Brown, my defense out there, fighting Faultless, was this question is not segregation, it's law and order.
Yeah, right. Had to equivocate on
that. Actually, there was a true statement. The question is, you're going to have rioting in the streets or you're
exactly.
not. And I knew damn well that Savageville wasn't going to put up with rioting in the streets. They'd put up with desegregation rather than that.
So even if people knew in their minds in 1950 that segregation was doomed, they couldn't know in their hearts. The minds and hearts here really were separated reality
they were,
got drummed into.
I have to remember that all of us had grown up, we'd never known anything except a totally segregated society. This is asking for a social change of a magnitude, leaving out all justice.
Yeah,
everybody had grown up assuming that this is the way the world was, and to say that we've been through this very bad experience getting rid of slavery.
Yeah.
But the question, I would say that even the most enlightened, best educated white person at that time, the question of justice wasn't really involved.
Hey, we ready to eat?
Well, we're beginning to, but
okay.
They're
not
in the
agency. No, we'll stop and come on down.
Well, they just to take getting to the table.
All right, we'll come on down. We can.
But sure, I'm trying to say, because it's very important, I think, trying to explain. Part of these books of mine, but only examining some of that, I'm trying to examine my own attitude. How did I get to this point?
Yeah.
From where I started, you know, what changed my mind?
Uh-huh.
And I think in my own case, it was largely a rational rather than emotional response. It wasn't a response to injustice, which I could see, but it was the fact that none of this made any sense. What we were trying to do. But if you think about the most enlightened white summer at that time, who would move out and stand up for the question of really injustice, which you could see against the black or blacks collectively. But the notion of simply admitting them into his own society, it was something that was so foreign to him, he would say, well, I'm not going to object. And the truth of the matter is, the only people who had to really tolerate that attitude, this is really true, it's always been a kind of a cliche, were the sort of upper class people who knew damn well instinctively that if the blacks all started intermingling, it wasn't going to affect them much anyway.
Mm-hmm.
They might accept a few blacks, but
they
were in charge of the community, and that wasn't going to change.
Right.
I mean, you could let those folks down there and get all intermingled.
Yeah.
And this is certainly a noble attitude. I've got increasingly obsessed with the notion. One of the tests I've put to myself a long time ago was saying, I know goddamn well that the Civil War was a terrible mistake. We were on the wrong side of the moral front where we couldn't win the damn thing. But I also know that if I'd been alive in that day, in my two grandfathers' day, I'd have been in the Confederate Army.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'd have thought then, but I know damn well the strong feeling I have now would not have been effective. You can't go back and project backwards into what people should have done on a moral issue like that. And I think that's the problem you face to some extent, trying to figure out why the South never voluntarily moved to end the injustice that a lot of Southerners recognized.
Yeah, I think I'm coming to see that it was just impossible.
It's expecting too much.
Yeah.
You see it now in South Africa. You see it. I read a review the other day, there's a new book about called The View of the Mind of South Africa, and the author, Alistair or somebody, I haven't read this, he says his inspiration was Cash's book, The Mind of the South. He's tried to analyze it, and he said the parallels are very great. Well, I think that's true.
Yeah.
Except the situation is so basically different.
Yeah.
Here we were with about a one-third minority, and there they are with about a one-third or less than that white people surrounded by blacks. So I've always said I can't pass a judgment on what the hell a white South African would do, but their society as they've now created it ain't going to exist once they get through.
That's right.
This was not true in the South. The South society was not going to be changed, hadn't been changed much. It's been changed some, and for the good.
Yeah. We'll pick up after lunch and talk some more. Some black press people. There was a guy named John McCrae in Columbia. it became rather noted because...
I didn't know. I remember the name, and he had, there was no black newspaper in South Carolina in my day of any significance with me. I mean, they were, every town had one.
Yeah.
And mostly they were shakedown situations. I mean, they shake down the white folks for some reason had to take an ad. I don't remember anybody, and you know, one of the myths of this whole thing is about how influential Daisy Bates' paper was. Well, Daisy Bates' paper was not influential at all in the black community or anywhere else.
Yeah.
But this, anyway.
This guy, John McCrae, wrote a weekly column called The Need for Changing. And if you read that column now, it was probably talking to nobody.
Yeah.
Nobody heard him.
Right.
But if they had been listening, they would have been wondering how in the hell they were going to dispose of this guy, because he really was looking down the road. And the significant thing he did in South Carolina is that he was the founder of the Progressive Democratic Party.
Yeah.
The black group that formed after the white primary thing.
Right.
He remained the titular head of it. Right on through, and they eventually put him on a chain gang for a libel conviction.
Yeah.
But he needs to be recognized, I think.
Should be, and of course you find, I think, in almost all these black newspapers, I said they had no influence, they usually were quite outspoken, I mean, quite radical in view. They were urging black rights.
Yeah.
But they had so little influence, the white establishment
paid no attention to them.
It didn't make any difference.
Right.
The blacks weren't influenced by them.
Right.
Individually, like Daisy's husband, old L.C. Bates, was absolutely outspoken. You know, he was for his people's rights.
Yeah.
And Daisy was too. Daisy was a very brave woman, but the newspaper itself was just of little consequence.
Uh-huh.
That's all I'm saying. The individuals were. Like McCrae, no doubt. I couldn't think of a black leader in my time in the South, in South Carolina, that was a visible presence as far as the overall white community was concerned. The only ones that you ever heard of were they were basically Uncle Toms or not, but they were the black preachers or the black college presidents.
Academic.
Accommodationists.
Right.
They were
mm-hmm.
the ones they'd trot out.
Right.
And,
One of the things he did about the
courtesy titles, and I think only in the South, a black attorney was always addressed as lawyer,
mm-hmm.
Lawyer
yeah.
Smith.
Right.
You'd give him a title. He couldn't. They didn't have one really, but mm-hmm. you're Lawyer Smith. You could.
Yeah.
Or Attorney Smith.
Yeah. You remember the case where the black serviceman passing through South Carolina on a bus right after the war and. Got into a fracas in some little town and the cops punched his eyes out and he was blind and became a big national...
Yeah, vaguely I remember it. I think I was gone by that time, after the war. I never got back there after the war.
Yeah, that's right.
I remember something about that.
This guy's name I can't remember now.
And there was another famous case that came along later, but this was a matter of trying to bury a black veteran in a veteran cemetery.
Yeah.
Where was that?
I can't remember now. That was in there somewhere.
That was a big issue.
Yeah. Then there were some black journalists from the North who, toward the latter part of this period, came south. Carl Rowan. Roy Otley.
Yeah.
And Ted Poston.
Ted Poston and Booker.
Booker somebody.
Booker.
James Booker.
James Booker. I knew Jim Booker. He was Amsterdam News, I think.
Was he?
Ted Poston was the only one, I think, from a white newspaper. He was the white New York Post.
I believe he was he was at the Post. He was a Southerner. He was from Kentucky.
Right.
And
Carl Rowan was...
he was with the Minneapolis Star.
And old Carl now has become one of the real reactionaries of our time.
Yeah.
Did you have any contact with any of those guys back then? I met almost all of them, particularly mm-hmm. after Little Rock.
Yeah.
When they all got there, they'd come around the Gazette.
Until Little Rock, you probably didn't see them?
I think I saw Carl Rowan once when he came through doing something.
Mm-hmm.
any of them that got down there would usually come around the newspaper.
Yeah.
And by that time, I was out in Little Rock. I don't remember. In Charlotte, maybe I saw some.
Uh-huh.
And I must say that they were given the usual courtesy of the house, as you would to any out-of-town reporter.
Yeah.
It was a custom on every newspaper I was there. Even in Greenville, I'm sure we were courteous. Probably couldn't take them to lunch. But
you let them
that's right,
come in for a visit.
That's right. Or whatever.
Yeah. The Dixiecrat Convention in 48. Did you go over there to Birmingham?
I didn't go. I was at the Democratic Convention when they walked out, and I had a lot of familiarity with it because Ben Laney was the first head of it, and then Strom Thurmond succeeded him.
Yeah.
He was elected at the Rump at the convention in Mississippi, which they adjourned and said they were going to Philadelphia and they might have to walk out, and they came back
to Birmingham
and actually set up the States' Rights Democratic Party. And elect Strom.
Yeah.
Old Ben would have been headed up, but he couldn't walk out of the convention because Bill Fulbright had him locked in. Bill Fulbright forced a unit rule in the Arkansas delegation. I was up there with him.
Yeah.
And so he couldn't...
wouldn't let him vote.
No, they wouldn't let him go, and he couldn't take the Arkansas delegation with him. But normally he would have controlled, the governor usually controlled the delegation, but Fulbright, who didn't want to do any bolting, had enough, got started early enough to load the delegation with a bunch of his people.
What do you think of Fulbright's role in all this?
Well, Bill Fulbright was an ornament, I think, of the Senate. He was wrong on the segregation thing, as I've said. Told a story, I guess I've put it in Hearts and Minds, about the call from Oxford. Remember that?
Yeah.
I told him they might as well enroll for the second semester. Well, Fulbright is quite candid about this in his own book, writing about this later. He said that he concluded that there was no way that he could be reelected and not sign the manifesto and take what he did more than that.
Yeah.
He actually entered an amicus curiae brief, right, which was inexcusable. And I've always said, I said to him, said to everybody else, I don't know whether that's true or not, but I point out that Estes Kefauver made it in Tennessee, and I'm not a damn bit sure that Fulbright couldn't have survived in Arkansas.
Yeah.
He made a conscious decision he was not going to deal with it. Again, he's interesting because he grew up there in Fayetteville, and there are no blacks up there, and that's way up in the corner, and the whole damn thing was an annoyance there.
Yeah.
He didn't have any racial prejudice. He could deal with all these black diplomats. But he just wanted the goddamn thing to go away. It wasn't important.
Yeah.
He didn't have any gut feeling about it. I've said this over and over again. As I did, as other people that were growing up around blacks, it might be bigotry, it might be the other way, but it was something. You had some feeling about these people. I don't think he did.
Yeah.
I said the whole thing to him was just a goddamn annoyance.
He
wished it would go away. But I think the greatest tribute to Fulbright was he'd been the university president, pretty good one, you know. He'd been president of the University of Arkansas. And the governor, political, ran him out of office because he was too liberal. That's when he ran for Congress. That started his political career.
In other words, he sort of got bumped out of his presidency?
He got absolutely run out.
He did.
Yeah, just by the governor. He had opposed, he'd supported the guy who lost, and the fellow who won, Homer Atkins, booted his ass right out. He controlled it.
What year would that have been?
It was before the war, because Fulbright was in Congress during the war.
Yeah.
And he went to the Senate after the war. But the tribute to Fulbright, I remember that after he finally got defeated in Arkansas, he shouldn't have run, but he did. And I remember going in and talking to Bob Hutchins the next day, and he, of course, knew Fulbright. And we were speculating about this, and I said, well, you can say whatever you want to say about Fulbright. You look back over the period he was there fighting McCarthy, he cast one of the few votes, only two votes against McCarthy. I said, what a different history this country would have had if we had 100 Fulbrights in the Senate during these years. And Hutchins said, I would have settled for 51. Led the opposition to the Vietnam War. He was Fulbright is an interesting guy. He's still alive, and if you get to Washington, you'll probably talk with him. I think he'd say about that. He's written, he just recently wrote another book out, which is kind of a reminiscence.
Yeah.
So you could find almost all these out. He's very candid about it. I've said, I don't know if he might have been damn right about that, that he couldn't be reelected. But he might have been wrong.
It just wasn't something he was willing to take a
chance. Well, if he had taken the chance, and I say the fact that Gore and Kefauver both survived in Tennessee, and Arkansas and Tennessee are very much alike.
Right, they are.
I think if he had been able to, he of course would have been Kennedy's Secretary of State.
Yeah.
It just ended his career.
Yeah, he
couldn't. He had this goddamn manifesto hung around his neck.
And so he ended up paying a pretty heavy price.
He sure did. And he wanted to be Secretary of State.
Yeah.
And Kennedy wanted him. But there was
no. But you don't think he was a racist the way Jimmy Burns was?
No,
his gut.
Not at all. I think he was indifferent to
that
thing. Right. He didn't. His whole reaction was one of irritation. He wanted it to go away.
Yeah.
It would have been perfectly suitable to him to desegregate. He didn't give a damn whether they did or didn't.
Yeah. It's kind of curious, you know, right in that period, right around the time of the war or right after the war, you had Ellis Arnold, you had Sid McMath,
right.
You had Jim Folsom.
Fulbright.
You had Fulbright. You had Claude Pepper, of course.
Right.
A number of people who really could have been the leaders of a real social movement, but they never got very far with it. I mean, they never really got even far enough to talk among themselves about leading such a movement.
Well, they all knew that they couldn't deal with the black problem. They set that aside, and you would get the liberal, you talk about that whole category of people, Kefauver and Fulbright and Ellis Arnold, their big pitch was we've been discriminated against on freight rates,
mm-hmm,
which is true. They
were hammered.
The other thing was resource development, Tennessee Valley, and building the dams, and this is to get some prosperity down here. Well, everybody's for prosperity, and everybody knew we were poor. So they were really off on the Henry Grady kick.
Yeah.
Basically,
that's what it came down to.
That was progressive, and of course they were big Roosevelt people because Roosevelt was for the resource development and this kind of thing. TVA was a very critical issue. In Arkansas, it spilled over there because the original proposal was to develop the Arkansas River instead of the Tennessee River.
Uh-huh.
And the old Joel T. Robinson, who was Roosevelt's majority leader in the Senate, and later was the vice presidential nominee, blocked the Arkansas thing for the Arkansas Power and Light Company.
Mm-hmm.
He also happened to be counsel for the Arkansas Power and Light Company. So then the big issue when I went out there, and this was a very much of an issue then, and it goes back into your own time, was to stop creeping socialism, which was TVA, from crossing the Mississippi River.
Right, right.
And so everybody in the Mid-South utilities, which merged up Arkansas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, they got all these political hacks to stand against any resource development out there, which to keep. And Fulbright was on the other side. I mean, he was for REA was a big issue too, the Rural Electrification Administration.
Did Fulbright want a TVA on the Arkansas River?
Yeah, he supported all that. He supported TVA. He supported the REA rural. In fact, that's where he got his big rural support. And that was lanyard for the country people to get those goddamn power lines.
Right.
In fact, the REA co-op movement in Arkansas is still a very powerful political force to this day. A congressman later became the head of it. What the hell was his name? He's dead now. I think he was a congressman from the Mountain District up there.
You remember the book that Arnold wrote, The Shore Dimly Seen?
Yes, I do.
Do you know anything about how that book came to be written?
Not really. I remember when it came out. My only connection with Arnold, I'd gone to Charlotte at the time of the two-governor crisis down here. The first time I ever saw McGill, I came down to write some stuff for the Charlotte News. I was the editor, but I wanted to. I couldn't stand. I wanted to see this confrontation. Herman Talmadge and Ellis was still trying to hold on to the office. And I went out to see him at that time, and of course it was a very distracting kind of interview, and the book was already out.
Yeah.
And I don't remember any of the circumstances.
Would you be inclined to think that he wrote that book himself, or had it?
I think it's entirely possible. I don't have any idea whether he did or not.
Did you ever hear of a guy named DeWitt Roberts?
Yeah,
a journalist here in town, here in Atlanta.
He may have had a ghostwriter.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't surprise me either way. I think Ellis Arnold was...
He was capable of writing it.
I had an idea the damn thing was really a collection of speeches,
mm-hmm.
pretty much. I mean,
it holds together surprisingly
well.
Yes,
it does.
And it's well written. And I think this guy Roberts wrote it.
Arnold was an intelligent and I think a fairly literate fellow, so I never heard that either way. It wouldn't have made any difference.
There again, though, here's a guy who was writing articles for National Magazine saying a day of liberalism is dawning in the South, but he wasn't talking about race.
No.
He really wasn't.
Race was off limits. They talked about anything else. You could talk about anything else. You could talk about the poor folks.
Yeah.
It was
not the subject.
Not the subject.
It's hard to get that point across, but it's true. Jay Wade, he's wearing.
I never met the judge. I knew Tom Waring, who was his nephew. The judge came along after my time in South Carolina.
Yeah.
And I read a lot about him, and I met his wife once somewhere years later. But you really have to... he was interesting because his seems to have been a rebellion against the Charleston establishment because he married this divorcee and they wouldn't take her in, and she was apparently a pretty sprightly lady.
Yeah, she
I never knew where justice lay in that, whether that really accounted for his attitude or whether it was attitude. He always said that he had begun, before he even got married, he'd begun to change his view. He began to see the real injustices and had to do. And of course, in that opinion of his, he stated that what the Supreme Court finally ruled, that segregation per se is unequal.
Yeah, that's where that phrase came from.
And he also blew up before that. He issued a couple of court opinions when South Carolina tried to repeal the Democratic Party and have it entirely private. He blew that
straight out,
and he also lectured the leaderships, and this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a really preamble to that.
Yeah, and that was ahead of all this other stuff, so
it was. He'd begun to take this position, and he always said, as I've read him quoted and stuff that he'd written, that his opinion began to change when he recognized what was happening. Now, I think he'd been Cotton Ed Smith's campaign manager. Mm-hmm. He'd been the counsel for Maybank.
He was an establishment man.
And he was a member of the St. Cecilia Society. I think he got thrown out when he married the widow.
Yeah. Do you think there were ever any communists in the South in positions of any authority?
I don't think there were. I'm sure there were a few. But they were so lack of... I never met a communist.
Isn't this more of a damn joke than anything serious?
Of course it is. What you had were people like Arnold Faubus's father, who old populist, old Eugene V. Debs socialist.
Right.
You had some of these more or less Marxists. But Christ, a Communist Party member, in Arkansas, the Communist Party, when they finally got somebody on the ballot, well, only got Henry Wallace on the ballot, there were so few communists in Arkansas that the headquarters of the Arkansas Communist Party was in Oklahoma City. They did two states because they didn't have enough to sustain an office in Little Rock. And I've thought about this. I don't remember seeing any known card-carrying member of the Communist Party in all my years of practicing journalism. When you'd be around, if they were around, you'd have seen them. They just were not around, and they were... And the blacks were never taken in.
Never went
for it. They were absolutely hostile to it. You couldn't. The whole thing was, it must have seemed amusing to them. These goddamn doctrinaire people talking Marx. Who in the hell could read Marx?
Right.
That wasn't ever it.
Yeah.
I have a deep-seated theory, which is a very unpopular one, I suppose, that the only justification for democracy, you've got to understand that but I get this out of my having to deal with populism in the South, and that populism is inherently conservative. It's never liberal, because it's based on self-interest, whatever the self-interest may be. You've got Reagan was, for Christ's sake, a populist. He would get appeal to all the people who were against government, who didn't want to pay taxes and whatever. So I think the only justification for the popular vote is that influence is negative. It puts a constraint on the elitists who are going to run the damn government anyway. But as far as affecting positive change, it won't do that. It'd probably go the other way. The best you can hope for is when they're quiescent, yeah, when they let a little progress happen,
yeah,
which is what happened in the South.
Yeah.
It was not that anybody wanted to desegregate, but they quit opposing it. It wasn't worth it anymore. And this is perhaps a cynical view, but I feel very strongly about this. If you appeal on a moral basis of doing what's right and what's just, it seems to me I can't think of an occasion when that ever carried as such, unless it was backed by a broad sense of self-interest. For example, at one time, all the liberals in the country supported the union movement. Well, this was a good social movement because it removed some authority from the establishment and put it in the hands of people. But of course, once the unions got established, they became just as reactionary and self-interested as any other part of society. And I think this is what the Southern experience shows. Populism in the South, it might have the highest motives, it might attract people of very high principle, but once it got to be a genuine majority movement, it turned on self-interest, and that's why the old original populists couldn't keep the blacks and whites together. I mean, Tom Watson tried it down here, and the last minute he reversed himself, mm-hmm, became a very white SIG, demagogue. And North Carolina, well, they had a fusion for a while. And Arkansas and most of the states, they never even attempted it. South Carolina, they didn't even have a populist movement as such. It was Ben Tillman,
yeah,
with his own. I mean, right, he had a populist appeal, yeah, which was against the trust.
Yeah. How did he lose his eye, you know?
I think it was a childhood accident. I don't think it had any... I don't think he was even in the... I think he was too young to have been in the Confederate Army. I think he was...
Yeah.
No, I think it was a childhood accident. I think it always had one eye, one-eyed curmudgeon,
yeah,
pitchfork head. And, you know, he was a very aristocratic fellow. I mean, yeah, these guys, he went out, you know, for the rednecks and rallied them, but...
he wasn't one of them.
Oh, not at all. He was a... He had a very distinguished library. He was a very learned kind of fellow. He was a lawyer, I think. I don't know where he went to college, maybe.
Yeah.
And the Arkansas demagogue.
Jeff Davis.
Jeff Davis. He was a graduate of Vanderbilt.
Yeah, right.
Now, these guys, most of them, were cold blues. These were old. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Establishment people that went out there and demagogued it up.
Yeah. Right.
Segregation, if that was what they needed, mm-hmm, or whatever the hell it was, against, yeah, the interest. Run against Wall Street, that was a, mm-hmm, big thing in the South. You'd, yeah, always run against the trust.
Right. Did labor have any impact at all in the 30s and 40s?
Damn little. It was beginning to have some, and in some places it did. But those were the days of the Textile Workers Organizing Committee, to try the big drive to organize the cotton mills,
right,
and they just fell flat on their ass. They would turn back.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when they came down, a woman named, what the hell was her name? She was a FASA graduate. She was in Greenville organizing.
Lucy Mason?
No, her name was, there was a fashion writer, had a very familiar name, Hawes or something like, mm-hmm, that. And old Lucy Randolph Mason was down here, and Dr. Witherspoon, who was a Methodist preacher.
Mm-hmm.
I knew all those, and but they were simply getting nowhere, and they didn't get into the segregation thing in those early days. They avoided that. They didn't, you know, trying to organize the goddamn lead heads. The last thing you wanted to do was
train racism.
after the war, they couldn't avoid it. And then some of the unions, like the auto workers, who were fairly big in Arkansas because it organized the aluminum plants down there. Well, they had Roy Reuther, and he was pressing a lot of liberal causes, really socialist almost. So they had to go along with that. The Teamsters were fairly progressive because they had a lot of black members in various capacities. And in fact, in Arkansas, at the time of the Troubles, well, Henry Woods, who was, he had said, was really representing the unions. The unions were going through the motions, but the old Smith, who was head of the Teamsters, was really the most effective one. He was an old bandit, I think. They all were stealing a little money. But I would say that overall, it wasn't until late in the day that the unions became any kind of a factor in desegregation, and mostly they were a handicap. Our craft unions in the newspaper were absolutely adamant. They were scared to death that some black was going to come in there.
The unions, to generalize, were far more visible on the side of segregation than on the side of immigration.
Oh, they were. I don't think there was any really conspicuous exceptions. There were a few individuals. Now later, when their internationals became really an issue, but the locals would give it lip service, but they wouldn't do a goddamn thing about really supporting it.
Were you in a veterans organization?
No, I avoided all of them.
American Veterans Committee, white group?
I had some sympathy for that, and then there was AMVETS. The American Legion I had nothing but contempt for. I wasn't going to touch it. The only reason for really joining any of those veterans organizations was back in those days, most of the states were dry, and they
and
almost
had
only
a place
had a
to
bar
drink.
If you went in a small town. It was the only place you could get a drink.
Yeah.
But I never joined any of them, and I never had any sympathy for them. I still don't. I mean, a professional veteran, it seemed to me, was absolutely... I've never even talked much about my own war record. I used to say, Bob Hutchins made a great joke out of this. I said to him once after I joined the board of the Funds of the Republic, I said, I have a strange circumstance. I said, as far as I know, I'm the only Southern newspaper editor who ever honorably came by the title of Colonel, and nobody ever calls me that. So that from then on, he always called me Colonel Ashmore.
You really did.
All these old
earn the title.
All these old,
everybody.
The old, everybody was a colonel or a major. Or captain was the lowest rank anybody had.
let's talk for a few minutes about the book. About the epitaph, and I'm going to stop on that, and I'm going to save till another time a long conversation about Hearts and Minds. There's just so much there. Part of what I want to do is to sort of give you some feedback on the book, because you asked me for that, and secondly, to ask you some questions out of it. One of the great strengths of it, and also the Hearts and Minds, as far as I've gotten, the second time reading it, is the great synthesis of Southern racial history that you put into both those books. I mean, you're very succinct and very nicely structured synthesis of how we got into the shape that we were in the period that you were writing about. In the epitaph, you talk about the three institutions of the, of the equal peculiarity in the post-slavery period: sharecropping, one-party politics, and segregation. And sharecropping was a sort of a way station on the way to God knows where. In a way, and
it was not just sharecropping; it was a one-crop economy. Which got everybody, planters and the small farmers, all committed to this interest, whether it was in their interest or not. But
And that got changed, and of course the party politics got changed.
Yeah.
But the segregation thing remained the problem, and in essence the subject of the
Well, the point I think I was trying to make was that these were interrelated. You had slavery, and it was slavery that made possible the one-crop economy, right. And also the one-crop economy required slavery.
Yeah.
Couldn't operate a plantation right. system. Couldn't operate without it. Now, you didn't have sharecropping of any significance, but slavery was still there. And then, of course, the one-party politics came into being to disfranchise the blacks, and it had the effect of keeping them, once they were disfranchised, they couldn't hold them in bondage anymore, but it maintained this pool of substandard cheap labor that the plantation system had to have. It had it under slavery.
Yeah.
And as long as these institutions held, when they began decaying for reasons of demography and economics, then it seemed to me, in the case I was trying to make, that segregation couldn't stand without them. But the
yeah.
segregation, the only thing it really buttressed it was the practical argument and the fact that you're going to have a plantation system, you had to have this cheap labor.
Right.
Then we reached the time, and by the time I got to Arkansas, you could look around and see this, we were losing population at a hell of a rate. And the fact was that blacks had become surplus. The plantations were all mechanizing. And incidentally, I meant to mention this to you, there was a fellow, there was a Neiman fellow ahead of me, he was on the Tennessean, who was one of the few people who really wrote about that whole sharecropping business. His name was Ned, he became really an expert. They sent him all over the South.
Ned Caldwell?
Ned Caldwell.
Was ahead of your class?
Well, yeah, he was in Neiman before me.
Is that right?
Or maybe he was after me, he wasn't in my class.
Geez, I had some idea he had come considerably later. No, he's dead.
Well, Nat was one of I was talking to John Sigenthal about this not long ago,
yeah.
And it was because this book came out where these two guys from California went back and revisited Let Us Now Praise
yeah.
Famous Men. Have you seen the book?
Yeah, I have.
Well, they go back and they went back and looked to see what had happened to the sharecroppers, the whites as well as the blacks, the continuation of that
right.
to now. And I said to John Sigenthal, I said, you know, This story was going on. This was the biggest economic story in the South,
mm-hmm.
and none of us were really covering it. And I said, the only exception I can think of is Caldwell.
Yeah.
Now, McGill did some of this before he mm-hmm. became editor, but Caldwell spent a lot all over the South.
Yeah,
he wrote about this basic fundamental change and what the hell was going to happen to all these displaced people.
Yeah.
Well, the blacks and a lot of the whites too went north.
Yeah.
They were leaving Arkansas. We actually had a net loss, real loss of population.
Yeah, yeah.
They were just streaming out. And the ones that are left now, and I was struck by this in this follow-up on what I saw in A.G.'s book, that these white sharecroppers have remained surplus population. A few of them got out, but the ones that stayed back are just marginal still.
They're still hanging on there. Yeah.
I mean, they're not on the land anymore. They can't even do that.
That's right. Ned Caldwell was a hell of a good reporter.
And there must be, did he ever publish any books?
Never did.
I don't think he
never
did.
Never did. He should have.
I guess the stuff was just in the Tennessee.
Yeah, that's the only place you would have seen it, I think.
Yeah.
You said when you wrote this book that the blacks' population, black decline in black population in number and percentage was really profound. It was happening fast.
Yeah.
Of course, that's turned around since then. I mean, I don't think the black population is declining in the South now.
Well, it continued to decline until after Brown, and then that stopped it pretty much. And it's now there's some in-migration.
Yeah, I think there is some.
But I think the demographic changes are still going on because of the white suburb, white ring vote, so that the cities still locked in or have an increasing percentage of black population, which does not reflect an overall increase in black population.
That's right. Yeah.
But in Hearts and Minds, I mean, in the Negro in the schools, the back end of that, the demographic chart
right.
showing the change that was taking
right.
place. In fact, we did county by county, did all the counties in the South,
mm-hmm.
and showed how they were changing and how few of them were remaining really black, only in Alabama and Mississippi.
Yeah, and that's pretty much stayed that
right.
way.
Right. And in Arkansas, there are still a few counties over there along the river and the Delta that are still black.
Yeah.
Poverty, pockets
Mississippi,
of poverty.
Mississippi, of course, is that way, too.
These people have nothing to do.
No,
I mean, they're just sitting
change.
There.
Yeah. at the time you wrote the Epitaph 2, there was no significant movement of blacks into elected public office.
No.
And of course, that's been a dramatic change.
That's right. Fairly recently, I've forgotten when the Texas decision was, 1948 or 49 or something like that, that ended the white primary. And that's when Harold was mixed up in it at the big voter registration drive for blacks that was throughout the South that fell far short of expectations. They mm-hmm. thought that black, and I think I suggested in Epitaph that it seemed to me what happened was that all the middle class, fairly illiterate blacks flocked in and registered, yeah. and the poor folks didn't show up. They weren't interested, and nobody was leading them, and they didn't think it made any difference whether they voted or not. In fact, it probably didn't.
You also point out in here that even as 56-7, when you wrote this right in there, that to the extent that Negroes had regained the franchise at that point and other legal constitutional rights, they had won most of those rights for themselves on the field of legal battle.
That's right.
Or as it turned out, and subsequently out in the streets.
That's right. But this was before that.
That was before the streets.
Right.
But you already perceived that that legal thrust was what was carrying, was not leadership. In fact, you go on to make
that right.
real strong indictment of the leadership. I love this statement. You said that over much of the region, a considerable majority is looking for a way out of the impasse. And you describe them as bewildered, disorganized, deploring the necessity, but nevertheless willing to move if led, if only, God damn it, somebody would lead them.
Right.
What they lack is public and private leadership.
There's one point to be made about the black vote. That before it got numerous enough to elect any blacks, it began to have a visible effect in cities. There was enough black vote.